Now, it's probably not a bad idea to bust a few myths about science. And I don't mind using those guys, even though they're a bit atheist, actually. But there's a lot of myths about science and evolution and Christianity. And one is that, in fact, it's a science versus religion battle. That Christianity and creation are religion and evolution is science. But let's think about that. The atheistic evolution is not an unbiased, objective understanding of nature. Here is one man, Thomas Nagel, who's an atheist. And look what he says. I want atheism to be true. And he's upset that there are a lot of intelligent, well-informed believers. But he says, it's not that I just don't believe in God and naturally hope there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. Now, recently, this guy has actually gotten into trouble with his fellow atheists because he's now written a book which is very sympathetic to intelligent design. Because he sees the shortcomings in evolution and admits that the design movement has a strong case. But he's still an atheist and a very staunch one, as we can see from here. Now, here's another one. Lawrence Krauss has been in the news as well. He's written a book called Something from Nothing, basically. He wants to believe that we don't need a creator for our universe. And he is a very good mate with Richard Dawkins. They had a big love fest between each other at the University of Arizona. But he says, I would call myself an anti-theist. Not just an atheist, but an anti-theist. He's against God. I'd actually use the word misotheist, a God-hater. Maybe I can't prove there's no God, but I wouldn't want to live in a universe with one. So he's got a bias. He's got an anti-God bias. He is not an objective scientist. I mean, I will admit my bias. I'm biased towards the Bible. Then the question is, why am I biased? Well, you may have a look at Christianity for skeptics and find out why I am biased. That is a good bias to have. But he's got a bias every much as strong as I have. And here's another case of bias here from Richard Lewontin, who's a geneticist and a Marxist from Harvard. And he said, we take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of its failure to fulfill many of its extravagant promises, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for just-so stories, because we have a prior commitment to materialism. Now, materialism in this context means that matter is all there is. And he said it's an absolute commitment because we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. So, I mean, never mind what the evidence says, he would not believe in an intelligent designer because he's already made up his mind that to accept materialism. He did not get his materialism from his science. He brought his materialism into his science. This is not objectivity. Now, another thing is, to show that it's not science versus religion, well, here's Michael Ruse, who's a philosopher, an atheist, and about 30 years ago, he testified in this big creation trial in Arkansas, where they wanted to teach a balanced treatment of creation and evolution in the schools, and there's a court case, the ACLU defended evolution only, and he was the ACLU's chief witness for philosophy, and he was very strong then that evolution was science and creation is religion. But after that, 20 years later, he said that evolution is promulgated as an ideology, a secular religion, a full-fledged alternative to Christianity with meaning and morality. Evolution is a religion. This was true of evolution in the beginning, and it's true of evolution today, an explicit substitute for Christianity. So they'll tell you they got rid of religion from the public schools. No, they didn't. They got rid of Christianity from the public schools and replaced it with this religion of evolution. And in some cases, the religion of Islam seems to be making inroads there, but not the true religion of the God of the Bible. And here's Richard Dawkins. Again, Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. So you see, he needs evolution as a crutch for his atheistic faith. He can't do without it. That's why he fights so strongly against challenges to evolution, because it undermines the crutch he has for his own faith. He could not be an atheist without Darwin. And that is why the Darwinists and humanists and the atheists, they were celebrating Darwin's bicentennial 4 years ago. Now, is evolution required for science? Well, here again, here's another one. Mark Kirshner from Harvard, who said, over the last 100 years, almost all of biology has proceeded independent of evolution, except for evolutionary biology itself. Well, what a surprise that is, okay? See, molecular biology, biochemistry, and physiology have not taken evolution into account at all. So this idea that somehow evolution is essential for science to work, well, real scientists clearly don't agree. That it really had nothing to do with real science. And in fact, in Australia, we had the same sort of thing, where a biology professor at one of the Australian universities, he was saying that evolution is so essential for biology, we can't possibly do biology without evolution, we've got to teach more of it. And then he laments in the same article, we can't get students to take evolution courses because it has no practical value. I mean, medicine. I mean, my father is a medical doctor, and he says evolution has nothing whatsoever to do with medicine. Because, I mean, a lot of the great advances in medicine were made before Darwin, and vaccination was discovered before Darwin by Edward Jenner. Okay, that's a very important advance. And you have things like Pasteur, the germ theory of disease. I mean, he was a contemporary of Darwin who rejected Darwinism. And from the germ theory of disease, we had Joseph Lister, another creationist, who discovered antiseptics to try and kill the germs that Pasteur had shown were responsible for diseases. And you have James Simpson discovering anesthesia, and he appealed to God putting Adam to sleep to make Eve from his rib. So he said, well, God used anesthesia, so can we. Okay, another thing. See, even antibiotics don't need evolution. See, one of the people who discovered penicillin and won the Nobel Prize was Ernst Chain. And he was an Orthodox Jewish creationist who is extremely scathing of Darwinism. So you see, even antibiotics was co-discovered by a creationist. So evolution has nothing to do with medicine either. So in fact, nothing to do with science. So the idea that evolution is science and creation is religion is one of the myths to be busted. Now, another very common myth is this Galileo idea of controversy between science and religion. And that turns a lot of Christian leaders into jello, and they use that as an excuse not to believe the Bible when it talks about six-day creation about 6,000 years ago and a globe-covering flood. Oh, Galileo, that's the only thing. Their mantra is the Galileo affair. But they've got totally the wrong message from the Galileo affair. When you understand the history, it in fact undermines their own case and not the Christian case. Now, here's an article on our website, creation.com/Galileo Quadricentennial. See, the quadricentennial of Galileo turning his telescope to the heavens is the same year as the Darwin bicentennial. In fact, the magazine New Scientist was asking which one of those was the most antagonistic to Christian faith, Galileo or Darwin. But I'd say Galileo wasn't antagonistic at all, unlike Darwin. Now, first of all, it's important to realize that Galileo was actually a case of science versus science. You see, Arthur Koestler said there existed a powerful body of men whose hostility to Galileo never abated, the Aristotelians at the universities. Yes, indeed, Galileo's discoveries were undermining the science establishment of his day, which has absorbed Aristotelian ideas, which includes the Ptolemaic model of the Earth being at the center of the universe. That was the science of their day. And Galileo is upsetting the scientists. And see, Koestler, who is not a Christian, has said innovation is a twofold threat to academic mediocrities. It endangers their oracular authority and evokes a deeper fear that their whole laboriously constructed intellectual edifice might collapse. Now, we see this with evolution today. It's a huge intellectual edifice. It undermines a lot of things, not just biology, but a lot of sociology and psychology are underpinned by evolution. The idea that somehow gay marriage is okay or an abortion is okay, all those are underpinned by an idea of evolution that things made themselves, and we're not accountable to a creator who's revealed his will to us in the Bible. Another expert on this is a Giorgio de Santillana, who said, it's been known for a long time that a major part of the church's intellectuals were on Galileo's side, while the clerics' opposition to him came from secular ideas. You mainly hear it was the church and the religion who opposed Galileo, but in fact Galileo's opposition was from the secular establishment, not from the church primarily. Now, see, here's... one of the leaders, Cardinal Bellarmine. Now, he's regarded, the Catholic Church call him a doctor of the church. Now, there are only about 30-something doctors of the church in the Catholic theology. Now, a doctor is a higher title than a saint in that. So he's regarded as one of the leading intellectuals of the Catholic Church of all time. But he said, if there are real proof that the sun is the center of the universe, and the earth is in the third sphere, and the sun doesn't go around the earth, but the earth around the sun, then we should have to proceed with great circumspection and explain the passages of Scripture which seem to teach the contrary. I don't think there is any such proof because none has been shown to me. But he showed a willingness to accept Galileo's idea because he realized Galileo's idea, as the medieval scientists realized, was more economical to have a small spinning earth than a huge spinning universe. So everyone realized that Galileo's idea made mathematical sense. It was a much simpler thing, because if you want to have the Earth at the center of the universe and you have things going around it, it's not a very simple path. You have to have epicycle, which is a circle rolling in another circle. The curve on that is called an epicycle. And Ptolemy's system, we needed more and more epicycles to make it work. With Galileo's system, in fact, all you need is the sun at the center and the planets going around it. In fact, Kepler was the one who solved it. Just a bit after Galileo, he realized that you can solve all the problems by having planets moved in elliptical orbits, and that was a very simple mathematical equation. And from that, Sir Isaac Newton, and to say another young Earth creationist, realized he could actually explain the elliptical orbits by having the three laws of motion and the law of gravity. So certainly, there's a very productive model for the development of modern science, while the Earth-centered model is not very productive. It seems ad hoc. And that was the main point about the Earth-centered universe. It's not very efficient. But the thing is, it had not been proved in Galileo's day. Galileo did not have the science on his side. We can look back 400 years and say, well, yes, of course the Earth is going around the sun. But in Galileo's idea, they didn't have that proof. So the thing is, we can't hold the church too much at fault when they didn't have the evidence. And Galileo was prone to exaggerating the evidence in his favor because he believed that the tides proved his theory. But that's actually wrong. So his main proof for the Earth's rotation was actually fallacious, because the tides are caused by the moon. So the thing is, Galileo did not have the science on his side at that time. Now the problem is, though, the church at the time after this did what theistic evolutionists are doing today. They married their science of the day to the Bible. They tried to make the Bible conform to the science of its day. And this is what the theistic evolutionists are doing. They're trying to make the Bible fit in with evolution, which you just can't do. But this is exactly what the church did in Galileo's time. They made science the authority and tried to find passages in the Bible that fit that authority. Like, here is one of them. The world cannot be moved. Okay, and they tried to recruit that to support the geocentric viewpoint of a stationary Earth. But in fact, this is not talking about that. And I can prove this very simply because the psalmist also says, I shall not be moved, using the same Hebrew verb. Now, does that mean the psalmist is in a straitjacket so he can't move? No, that's not what it's talking about. The word move means to falter and depart from the path that God has set in front of us. This is talking about God being in control of everything, that the earth and the psalmist will not falter from the path that God has set out for him. Nothing to do with cosmology here. And that applies to all the verses they were trying to recruit into supporting their earth-centered model. Now, another thing involved with the Galileo affair was papal politics, because Galileo was actually a very good friend of a cardinal who became Pope Urban. And in fact, the cardinal and Pope actually encouraged Galileo to publish his ideas. So they were very open to Galileo at that time. And you see, James Hannam says that, in fact, academic historians are convinced that this had much to do with the politics and the Pope's ego as it had to do with science. You see, when Galileo had a very abrasive personality and put down his opponents a bit unfairly, now, in those days, they would publish their views in the form of a dialogue. So he published a view as a dialogue between a guy who believed in an Earth-centered universe and a sun-centered solar system. The problem is Galileo chose a character called Simplicio, which means the fool, to represent the Earth-centered universe, and the Pope recognized his own arguments in the mouth of the fool. So he thought that Galileo was trying to make him look foolish. So, of course, these once best friends became bitter enemies. And this is why we have these trials of Galileo, because purely because of the Pope. Because most of the churches, the intellectuals, did not care about this. They realized that Galileo had said nothing heretical. It was just against what the Pope believed. It was a direct attack on the Pope. And I can prove this because just about 30 years after Galileo died, the Jesuits were teaching Galileo's ideas to the astronomers in China. So clearly it wasn't a science versus religion thing as far as most of the church was concerned. And they even used their cathedrals as giant sundials to analyze the heavenly motions. And they used that to help support Galileo's views. So once Galileo and the Pope had died out, there was no opposition to Galileo after that. And as I say, most of the people who developed the Galileo viewpoint were young Earth creationists like Kepler and Newton and Galileo himself. And Copernicus was a canon, basically a priest in the Catholic Church too. And the medieval theologians and medieval scientists were also priests like Oreim and Buridan, who likewise saw nothing to contradict the Earth moving position, which I call geokineticism, Earth moving. And they saw nothing in the Bible to conflict with that. Now, how do you solve this problem? Well, the answer is you think of things called reference frames. What have I got here? That's a speedometer. And it's set to zero. But hang on, isn't the Earth going about 1,000 miles per hour around its axis? And much faster still around the Sun? So how could that speedometer be right? Well, the answer is the speedometer is calibrated in reference to the ground. And any physicist knows that all motion must be described in relation to something else. You have to have a fixed reference point to describe motion in relation to it. And you can select any reference frame you like. And just for most purposes on Earth, it's convenient to have the Earth as a reference frame. Your stop signs and speed limit signs are calibrated with Earth as a reference frame. I don't think you could tell a traffic cop, you get a ticket for running a red light or something, and you say, well, I can't possibly stop because the Earth is moving so fast around the Sun, stopping's impossible. Or things like, we use the word sunset today. Sunset is an Earth-centered term. It's far more convenient to say sunset at 7 o'clock than to say that at 7 o'clock the line of sight to the sun intersects the horizon tangentially. That's harder to say, isn't it? So much more convenient to say sunset, and it's physically equally valid to do that. And see, Fred Hoyle understood this perfectly well because he said that we cannot say the Copernican theory is right and the Ptolemaic theory wrong in any meaningful physical sense. All it is a choice of what reference frame you use. And that's what he says here in fairly complicated terms, that in fact they are exactly equivalent from a physical point of view, just a matter of choosing what reference frame you want. So Galileo could have solved the whole problem, because when he was asked, does the Earth move, he should have asked, in relation to what? Because the Earth does not move in relation to the Earth. So that's perfectly valid science. And one more thing I'll mention about Galileo is, in fact, the New Scientist article I referred to said that Galileo dethroned Earth from its privileged central position. But in reality, as far as they were concerned, the central position was the worst place to be because they believed hell was right in the center of the Earth. That's horrible. And even the Earth itself was fallen. And the further away you got from the heaven, the closer you approach perfection. See, one of Galileo's discoveries that really upset this belief system of their day is the discovery of sunspots. Now, sunspots show there's imperfections on the sun. But according to this scheme here, the sun was supposed to be perfect. Now, the point about this is that when Galileo puts Earth to the third planet around the sun. In fact, in that system, he was promoting it by moving it further away from the center. So once again, people have looked at Galileo anachronistically, reading our own worldview into the time 400 years ago, which you just can't do. So conclusion from this is a myth that Galileo controversy was science versus religion. But if you know the facts, you realize this is a complete and utter myth, and it was mainly science versus science. And then lesson from that is, don't marry your theology to today's science, because you'll be widowed tomorrow. Now, one more belief I'd like to tackle is this common idea that the church taught a flat earth in the Middle Ages. And in fact, even your president has resorted to this fallacy. He said if some of these folks were around when Columbus set sail, they must have been founding members of the Flat Earth Society. They would have not have believed the world was round. So when you have the most powerful man in the world actually still believing this false anti-Christian history, there's a problem, I think. Because in reality, the church believed in a global earth. And this is documented about 20 years ago by a book called Inventing the Flat Earth by Jeffrey Burton Russell, a historian. And even the evolutionist Stephen Jay Gould praised this book very highly as being an incredibly accurate source of what the church really believed about the shape of the earth. Because he analyzed what the scholars of the church really taught. And in fact, the vast majority of the church scholars who discussed the topic believed the earth was round. Only a handful of guys, maybe one or two or three people below, believed that the earth was flat. One of them was called Cosmas Indicopleustes, which means voyager to India. Well, who's heard of him? Well, that's the whole point, isn't it? These are obscure figures. And now the atheists were saying that the Indicopleustes was typical of the church. In fact, he was very much an odd man out. Now, far better known in the church was the Venerable Bede in the 8th century. And he said, we call the earth a globe. That's not a flat earth there. And just in case you didn't get it the first time, he said the earth will represent the figure of a perfect globe and not circular like a shield, but round like a ball. So you get the idea? He believed the earth was ball-shaped, not flat. And this was centuries before Columbus. And this is a very important figure in the medieval church, the Venerable Bede. Now, the best theologian of the Middle Ages was probably Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century. And he said the physicist proves the earth to be round by one means and the astronomer by another. So the leading textbook in the Middle Ages, the Summa Theologiae, taught the earth was round. Because they knew about eclipses. You see, a lunar eclipse, you can see the shadow of the earth passing over the moon, and the shadow is always round, which is only possible if the earth is ball-shaped. They knew perfectly well that the earth was round. Sailors knew it better than anyone, because there's a myth about somehow people saw the masts disappearing below the horizon. More likely to be the other way around. Before telescopes, it was the sailors coming in who would see the mountains appearing first before the lowlands. That's what it was. So at least sailors in particular were in a good position to know the earth was round. Another thing that we know is also this symbol called the Globus Cruciger, which means the cross-bearing globe. And medieval rulers, the kings and emperors, used a globe to symbolize their power on earth. And the globe, of course, symbolized the earth. Now, isn't that interesting? A globe is symbolizing a flat earth. But you see, see how these guys are all holding a globe, and the huge cross over the globe is big because it's important, not because it's literally that big, but because the Christ is all important. So what this globe is doing, as you see in these several pictures here, they're all holding globes, is because they believe that Christ was a lord over the whole globe, but the king holding the globe, it was symbolizing that he held dominion over this portion of the globe under Christ. So right from the 8th century, you have a symbol called the Globus Cruciger, which showed that the kings and emperors believed the earth was round. So this was common knowledge in the secular rulers and in the church that the earth was round. Now, the issue of Columbus actually had nothing to do with the shape of the earth, because no one disputed it. The issue with Columbus, in fact, was the size of the earth. He got the wrong meaning of the word mile, because the Arabs had a different mile from the Italians, and therefore he actually underestimated how big the earth was. So if anyone laughed at Columbus, they were laughing at him because he didn't have enough provisions for his voyage. But remember, he wanted to reach India by sea the long way round. And in fact, his critics were right. He had actually got too smaller distance. And they were quite correct that he didn't have enough food to reach India the long way round. It was complete dumb luck. There was a continent in the way. But he thought he reached India. That's why the people today, the natives, are called Indians, because Columbus called them Indians. He thought he'd reach India, so these were the inhabitants of India. But again, it was only luck that he actually found the continent. But his critics were right. Columbus had underestimated the size of the earth. That was the issue, not the shape of the earth. But unfortunately, we have Washington Irving, one of your first American novelists. He was the one who invented this complete and utter fiction of Columbus being laughed at because he was the only one in the world who believed in a round earth. This is a complete and utter fiction. And then atheistic humanists like Andrew Dixon White and John Draper. I mean, Andrew Dixon White was a founder of Cornell University as a secular university, and they were trying to use this myth of the flat earth to bash opponents of Darwinism. That's what we have today, because Richard Dawkins is quite fond of accusing creationists of being flat earthers. He's continuing this false history to attack opponents of Darwinism. But in fact, it is an utterly, completely false history. Now, one last thing I'd like to leave you with about this is that, in fact, the leading evolutionist, the leading flat earther in the world today is an evolutionist. There is actually a flat earth society, and its members believe that the earth is a flat disc you can fall off of. But the leader of that society believes that's in evolution and in global warming. So if an evolutionist like Dawkins calls you a flat earther, you should point out that the leading flat earther is one of his fellow evolutionists, not a creationist. So again, this is a bit of an irony, the leading flat earther is an evolutionist, not one of us. So here's again another myth that's been busted, that the early church and medieval church believed in a flat earth. There's actually no historical basis for it. It's completely contrary to history. And yet this is a lie which has been taught to attack Christianity. But thank you very much for listening to me, because I think this is actually a very important part to understand the history, because these are the arguments that atheists often throw at the church. And in fact, also those who want to compromise with long ages and evolution will throw these things at you as well. So it's important to have the historical facts so you know how to answer these false charges.